Welcome to the Mike Lazaridis Theatre of Ideas here at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. And welcome to Perimeter's public lecture series presented by Sun Life Financial. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach here at Perimeter, and it is my sincere pleasure to welcome everyone here today, both those of you here in studio and those of you watching online on our many science communication colleagues' websites and Facebook pages around the globe. The lecture today will last approximately 1 hour and will be followed by a question and answer session. For those of you online, we have Dr. Kelly Foyle and her team of PI researchers in the chat zone behind their keyboards ready to engage in discussion throughout the lecture. If you want to participate in that conversation, use hashtag PILive. And now, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce tonight's very special guest speaker, Dr. Cameron Smith. Dr. Smith received his PhD from Simon Fraser University and is now an archaeologist at Portland State University's Department of Anthropology. Dr. Smith has published widely on the anthropology of space exploration and colonization, and most recently was in Scientific American magazine and, of course, in his new book. Dr. Smith aims to advance human space exploration by developing new techniques and technologies. He's a diver, a mountain climber, a paraglider pilot. Dr. Smith is applying his many years as a solo Arctic ice cap expeditionist to devise ways to explore the surface of distant worlds. Dr. Smith flew in late last night, arriving from Belgium, to speak to us today on the biocultural science of a long-term space settlement. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Cameron Smith.
Thank you. Thanks very much for coming. And for welcoming me, this is the second time that I've been welcomed very warmly by Canada. The first time was between 1996 and 2004 when I was a student at Simon Fraser. And Canada supported my life. Canada, through a lot of scholarships, supported my scholarship. So thank you, and thanks once again. I'm awfully honored to come here to a place where I have an hour to speak to what I consider to be magicians. I came and looked at this strange building with the snow swirling around and this interesting architecture, and I had seen strange mountains that looked something like this in Iceland a long time back, and there my mind was, I was thinking about wizards up in the mountains, and there are a lot of tales of trolls and wizards and sorcery up in the mountains of Iceland. And this reminded me of that. And I thought, wow, I've come to another palace of magicians. And that's really what I think of because, you know, Asimov, I believe it was Asimov, who said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And that's what I think of when I think of theoretical physics. I know that you know what quantum mechanics are. I know that I have an inkling of what that might mean, but I really don't understand it. To me, it's a magical thing. So to be asked to come and speak is quite an honor for me. So thanks once again. I'd like to talk about a proposition for humanity that's really astounding. And, you know, we've seen a lot of things go from science fiction to science fact in the last few centuries, or even let's restrict it to the the Darwinian era since 1859. And one of them, I think, that's going to come up and become a reality for us in the next few centuries is the possibility of going to some of the exoplanets that we're now able to see with this incredible technology, of these new, different varieties of detecting exoplanets. And this will allow humanity to do something that it's been thinking about for a long time, which is going to a different place, a very distant place, and settling there. And my argument, as I'll develop it here tonight, or at least I'll introduce, my argument is that that is a completely natural thing. It is in line with everything else in the history of living things on Earth, at least the history of Earth evolution. It's completely natural for humanity to continue the trends that we see in 3.5 billion years of Earth evolution. And these include expansion into new ecosystems and adaptation to them. That's why I'm describing this as interstellar voyaging as an evolutionary transition. I'll come to that right at the very end, what an evolutionary transition is. But in the world of evolutionary biology, substantial reorganizations of the information systems of living things, and that's DNA on the biological side and cultural information in the system of cultural transmission that is pretty much unique to humanity. Significant reorganizations of the information content in those domains constitutes evolutionary transitions. There have been about 8 in the history of Earth life. For example, from asexual to sexual reproduction. Among those, I believe the next one, if we look at the history of evolution, I believe that the next evolutionary transition is going to incorporate or is going to be composed of humanity's settlement of environments beyond Earth and complete disassociation from Earth life. As long as we're attached to Earth, we're still not into that transition. Anyway, we'll come back to that a little bit later. If we look at what NASA does, and we're moving out of the time where space exploration and so on are completely the domain of NASA. But if we look at what NASA does, let's say, and there, of course, there are a lot of other space agencies. Well, it's sometimes difficult to get an idea of exactly what they do. But if you go to some of their websites, you can find that their mission statements include, very significantly, statements about life. So, for example, they are focused on improvement of life here. This is from a recent mission statement. I think it was about 2010. I found this. Improve life here, that is on Earth. To extend life there, that is, extend life beyond the surface of Earth. That's starting to get into what I'm talking about. And then to find life beyond. What I think is most interesting about this is that when you think about NASA, oftentimes when we think about NASA, we consider machinery, the technology, the hardware, computer programs, telescopes. All of these statements have to do with living things. It is about life. Those machinery, or that machinery and so on, those are tools to implement the investigation of and the perpetuation of life. Well, if you're going to deal with life, going to deal with living things, then you deal with change. All living things change. There are a handful, I just look at the list of them, the most recently published list of what are called living fossils. These are life forms that haven't changed too terribly much in the last tens of millions of years. But even they, that's only up to skeletal biology, and genetically we know that they have evolved. So all living things change through time by the processes of evolution, and Darwin made those very clear 150 odd years ago. And those are guiding principles in the approach that I'm going to present tonight. Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution is the way that Dobzhansky put it in 1973, and that's a beautiful encapsulation. There's been an interest in human space settlement, and not just the exploration of space, but the settlement of space for a long time. But it's only in the last generation or so, and perhaps even in the last decade or so, that we see the costs of space access is going down, and a lot more people are becoming involved or interested in making space exploration cheaper and easier. Here in the United States, specifically, we think of SpaceX, who are really focused on reducing cost. And there are other places, for example, ISRO, the Indian Space Research Organization in India, are working on a manned space program, or I should say humanly crewed space program. In the 70s, there were depictions like this of what life would be like in vast orbital colonies. These came from the work of Gerard K. O'Neill, who died, unfortunately, rather early, but he had about a 10-year period where he really pushed the concept of space colonization and space settlements, and there were a number of design studies, partly sponsored by NASA. And they came up with these beautiful designs. All the science was there as well. They figured out all the consumables and the calories and all of that. But of course, it was all theoretical. And when you start to build the ecology of closed systems like this, it gets awfully difficult. But they started out pardon me, in the 70s, this was really going for a while, and then it sort of fizzled out by the 80s, and other national priorities came along. But now we're looking at this kind of thing again, and much more specifically, though, people are looking at Mars as a first destination, the first place to go. In substantial numbers, and ultimately in numbers or in populations that become what we might call completely independent of Earth. To do that, for example, or to do that, to make a success of that attempt to spread humanity and civilization beyond where we are today, is going to require a science of adaptation to these environments. And it's going to require a science of adaptation that specifically deals with humans, although we will have to take a lot of domesticates as well, plants and animals, and of course all of our genetic hitchhikers, all of the microbes that keep us alive, that ride inside our bodies. When I come to talk about genetics, you'll see, or I'll remind you that we have to take care of their genomes as much as we do the human genome. We require then a science of extraterrestrial adaptation. Now, I'm using the term extraterrestrial here, and I'm using that in it's a scary word, because when you say extraterrestrial, people think of ET, they think of Hollywood, and they think of the movies. And so, in publications, I'm not using that very much, but it's a very technically specific term: extra, alpha of or beyond, terrestrial, Earth. So we really do require a science of extraterrestrial adaptation. I won't spend too much time on the issue of should we do this, or is this a good idea? I think it's the idea of spreading humanity and preserving civilization spatially, that is, by moving and becoming at least a multi-planet species. One reason I believe that is, as a prehistorian, my work has shown me very clearly the dissolution or collapse or disintegration, however we want to term it, of all of the ancient civilizations. Egypt went through several periods of civil war before finally being conquered by Greece, and its religious traditions were dissolved. Each of the stars in these diagrams, each of these stars represent a particularly significant collapse. One particularly significant collapse. We don't always know the reasons for the collapses. You can read about the whole world of collapse. You can find it in a book recently called Collapse by Jared Diamond. There are other more scholarly books that I think make it use a better term, which is disintegration. Civilizations are funded by the backbone of agriculture. But they are held together, it's very interesting, they're held together simply by agreements and by participation in the ways to behave. It turns out that those can be rather fragile, and civilizations have essentially, we've seen, a 99% failure rate. And if you average these, I've run some numbers on these things, and there are all kinds of problems with averages, but if you average these, you're looking at about 1,200 years per civilization, for all the ancient civilizations, a duration of about 1,200 years. There's nothing inevitable about that figure. So we shouldn't necessarily worry that we're on the order of that if we want to start from the Renaissance, or I should say from Greece or Rome or something like this. We shouldn't necessarily worry about that, but still, an interesting index. So again, I'm not going to spend much time on whether we should, whether this is necessarily a good idea. I'll be happy to try to answer some questions about that at the end. But I'm going to put forward the premise that it's a significantly important thing and that we should do to, or it's significantly important for us that we should preserve civilization and not allow it to disintegrate this time. Just before I continue on, one of the reasons is that it's not just civilization that is being preserved, it's consciousness, the variety of human consciousness that I think is awfully important to preserve. We've long considered space exploration. Recently, however, we've been in the mode of what we call exploration, finding a thing and then coming back to describe it. If you look at the root of explore, it's ex, go out somewhere, plore, which is to come back and describe it. So this has been, we've been in an exploratory mode for quite a while. But we need a significant shift in how we think about all of this. In fact, this is just one of about 10 major shifts when I started researching how do we make this more probable to succeed. Well, of course, we're going to presume that all the technology, the life support technology, we're going to presume that all of that works. But how do you motivate people to consider this to be a useful or worthwhile project for humanity? And that social motivation is absolutely critical. At the end of his book, The Case for Mars, Robert Zubrin, president of the Mars Society, describes a 747 sitting on a tarmac, and he says, all the technology is sitting there, and it's all capable of flight and all of that, but without a human being in the front seat, it's not going anywhere. He's pointing out you must have a social motivator. To get a social motivator, I think we need a lot of shifts of consciousness in how we think about space and space exploration. For example, I think we have to go away from the concept of the super individual, these extraordinarily qualified people for their very specific tasks of early space exploration. We need to go away from individuals, and we're going to have to think about communities, populations of people. After all, a space colony or space settlements are not going to be composed of thousands of pilots, test pilots sitting around. It will be mostly, of course, it will be farming people. It's agriculture is the backbone of all the civilizations. So it'll be farming people, people are doing manufacturing, everything that we do today. And most of us are not these extraordinary singular test pilots, for example. So we needed a shift. This is one of many, and I'm not going to focus on those today, but this is one of many things. We'll go away from then, for example, when we look at the living system itself, away from biology or flight physiology of individuals on short time scales, so sending one or two or five people up to the ISS for a year or something less than a year and looking at what's called flight physiology or biology, and towards a larger science of human life, which is anthropology, which is my field. And anthropology itself is divided into, for example, biological anthropology, that is the biology of the human species, cultural anthropology, the study of living cultures, archaeology, the study of ancient cultures, and linguistics, the study of human communication system, which are pretty unique. Where to begin with all of this? If you're going to propose, this really is how I got funneled into this. I was interested in space exploration and settlement for so long, but talk to people and they say, well, how are you going to do it? I was sort of forced into saying, okay, here, I'll show you how we're going to do it. I'll have to write a description of how we're going to do it. You're pushed into sort of describing very specifically. I didn't want to talk about generalizations anymore. Rather recently when I started talking about this, I didn't want to just point to a couple of science fiction movies or a couple of novels and say, well, it could be sort of like this. I wanted to get really specific about how this might be possible. So, a book underway now is Principles of Space Anthropology, Establishing a Science of Human Space Colonization. And I'll focus on biological and cultural changes required to make a good probability of success for human space colonization. People are biological. Biological systems change by the processes of evolution. Evolution in biology is considered can be defined as the change of gene frequencies in a population over time. We'll come back to that. The graphic shows you, of course, the DNA molecule that accounts for the physical constitution of humanity. We also have a significant component of cultural information that's required for full humanity as well, but that's not visible here. Our genome continues to evolve, so I'll start with biology, and then we'll go into cultural change. Main factors in biological evolution, in population genetics, let's say, are mutation, migration, selection, and drift. And we can look at each of these to see how they play into this world of space colonies. For example, mutation is a result of a wide variety of mutagens. Mutagenesis produces, and these could include X-rays or cosmic rays. This was from an old paradigm which thought of mutations as what's called a zap phenomenon, where you have the DNA sitting there passively, cosmic ray comes in, knocks a couple of letters out of sequence and you've got a mutation. It turns out, yes, that does occur, but it turns out much more mutation is the result of the failure of many repair mechanisms that go in and reorder disorders that come from zap mutations. That's turning the concept of mutagenesis on its head from where it was 50 years ago. I'll come back to that revolution in understanding biological evolution as we go along. Mutagenesis, however it's done, however it arises, it introduces variation. It introduces novelties or innovations in the biological system. Ecologists measure the health of populations by the genetic diversity. And that's because through time, we know that environments are going to change. The things that determine whether you are fit or not will change. The environment changes. And if everyone is identical, if there is uniformity in the genome, everyone is liable to a selective sweep, where something changes, nobody can survive, they all die off. Actually, health then of the population is measured in its genetic diversity, which allows enough variation such that no matter what change comes along ecologically in terms of natural selection, whatever change comes along, somebody is still around to survive it. There are mutations in the human genome that have allowed adaptation to all kinds of conditions. In the Tibetan plateau and also in the high Andes, they've arisen independently, but there are mutations in the genome that have allowed better oxygen transport. One involves the ATRX gene. They have to do with hemoglobin and with oxygen transport, and they're instances of biological adaptation of human populations to unique environments. Okay? These are populations, both of those regions settled more than 10,000 years ago. At those times, humans went up into these high altitudes and they have biological adaptations. Now, of course, they didn't know that. They didn't know that they had this mutation. They didn't consciously do that. And in fact, the process of evolution didn't know that was happening. The process of evolution doesn't think, aha, we need to increase oxygen transport. The paradigm of evolution today initially occurs as a random occurrence, random instance, and then because it makes the life form more fit, it increases their fitness, then it persists. Another rare variety of mutation that has arisen independently in different populations worldwide is the capacity for lactose tolerance after weaning. And this allows digestion of lactase after weaning period, after about 3 or 4 years of age. And that appeared in populations that were doing domestication of milk-giving animals. So we have genetic adaptations. We also have cultural adaptations, which we'll come back to later. We can expect that both beneficial and deleterious mutations will arise beyond Earth in these new environments we go to. This brings up the process of selection. Natural selection is essentially the differential survival of individuals of a population of variable individuals. That is, of a population that are not all identical. Some survive in better health in their environment, and they pass on genes. They pass their genes on more commonly than their companions or their peers. There are dozens of ways to define natural selection, but that's one of them. Non-random differential survival of randomly varying individuals. When we look at different environments that humanity might be exposed to in adaptation to places beyond Earth, there are basic conditions that could easily result in natural selection or selection against variation in our populations that we haven't thought about. For example, gas composition. On Earth, of course, we're breathing roughly 20% oxygen at sea level. Roughly 20% oxygen. And we live under about 14.7 psi, or 1 bar atmospheric pressure, again at sea level. And we have evolved over the last few million years under 1G gravity. Okay, these are basic conditions that have shaped the mammals and the primates and ourselves of the primates. And we'll come back to how slight variations in those essential characteristics of our environment can have significant effects on the human genome and human individuals. These will differ from Earth normal conditions that have shaped the human embryo. Migration is another one of these forces or one of these factors that change or that are involved with the evolution of populations. Migration introduces or reduces variation. So you can have new genes come into a population, or certain segments of genes or certain subpopulations might take entire sets of genes out of a population by migrating out or migrating in. The founder effect is particularly important here. When we propose putting people into a starship and sending them to an exoplanet, the genetic composition of those first people, those first the people aboard, will be the essential raw stock for the first colonists, let's say, or settlers of that exoplanet. The founder effect is the simply the recognition that the that when small populations split off from a larger population and they colonize a place like the Hawaiian Islands or some environment separate from where they originate, the genetic composition of the following populations, right, begins with that one. So that's founder effect. We will see that just as biological health measured by ecologists for non-human life is measured as or is counted as a measure of biological diversity, we're going to have the same thing with human genetic diversity. And I'll come back to that in a few minutes. This brings up this specter of what's called genetic screening. And there are some of the most fascinating issues involved with interstellar voyaging and this kind of project of colonizing environments beyond space. Really does bring up these issues of reproductive rights and the moral issues of space colonization. I'll come back to all those, and I'm sure that there'll be a couple of questions about them. We will need some variety of screening, just as we maintain and take care of our genome today. We will be watching out for the health of the genome when these populations are established. We'll come back to all of that. Modern genetic diversity of humanity can be measured in all variety of ways, and we can see that, I'll come back to the numbers that are required for viable genetic populations of humanity, but we can see that the diversity of humanity, genetically speaking, most diversity is actually relatively young in the last 100,000 years or so, where we have evolved into essentially our modern species, Homo sapiens sapiens. This picture just shows you that we're able to measure, and we have a good handle on the sort of genetic diversity of human populations. That's come up even just in the last 20 years of modern genomics. Selection, another thing we think about commonly in evolution, selection reduces variation essentially by eliminating deleterious variations. So an individual born with characteristics that are not very suitable to its environment, for example, a fly that is born without wings, if it's required for that fly to have wings to propagate its own genes, it's unlikely to persist, right? That characteristic of winglessness is unlikely to persist. Selection is not gone from the human genome. In fact, in what we might call the developing world, there are many people who are still under selection and being selected against by disease. Even in the developed world, there is significant selection in human fetal chemistry. I was just at a conference where there was a paper called Toxic Baby, and it was describing that in a survey of European umbilical cord chemistry, there has not been a case where that was free of pollutants. And so we are creating our own selection against our own offspring by the pollution that we've put into our own environment. So selection returns, or selection continues, and it will return on all variety of scales and in all variety of environments. For example, if we put people into Earth orbit, there are conditions there that will select against certain developmental schedules developmental chemistry, let's say. Lagrangian points, these are free-floating places where you're not drawn one way or another gravitation, or not very much, and those are candidates for some variety of colonization. These are free-floating in space. Of course, we can put colonies on the moon. Well, there you're under 1/6 gravity. You can go to Mars, there you're under 1/3 gravity. Those are different conditions, again, from the 4 million years of hominin evolution, the 65 million years of primate evolution, the 100 or so million years of mammal evolution. The interstellar arc I'll come to in a couple of minutes. It's been pointed out that the most perilous time of your life is during the phase of early cell development or early cellular differentiation called gastrulation. That's when things could have really gone the most haywire. That's the most dangerous moment of your life. There's an entire chemistry, of course, and an entire genomics of developmental schedules. It used to be thought, of course, that you have one gene that punches out amino acids. Those are assembled into proteins, and they build tissues. One gene to one phenotypic, or one gene to one physical characteristic. In the last 30 years, it's become very clear that there are also what are called developmental genetics, and that certain genes regulate others, and they might regulate many others, and they switch them on and off. It's much more complicated. Those developmental schedules, and you can see, well, you don't see them, but they're being played out on these different time periods in fetal development. Those can be awfully sensitive to environmental change. We'll come to that as well. We've seen some reproductive biology studies have been done in International Space Station and other space stations in low Earth orbit, and those have shown us that, for example, amphibian embryo development can be severely affected. This was done on newts or frogs, the embryo development was severely affected by high oxygen and slightly lower pressure environments. It wasn't 100% oxygen environment, and it wasn't zero gravity. This was even on Earth. This was slightly different environmental conditions, lower pressure conditions. And this interrupted the developmental cycle. We'll come back to some issues here as well. So selection. Oftentimes, when we think about natural selection, or when we invoke the idea of selection against individuals in human populations in environments beyond Earth, we think of very dramatic cases of a person getting sucked out of an airlock or eating something, and they're eating a Mars microbe, and they get sick and die. But really, the selection, though, we're presuming that that adult humans are going to be able to use the technology and they're going to be able to manage. But I think the selection is really going to come in. The return of natural selection is really going to come in for the first few generations in terms of those developmental genetics. And I think that we're going to start with greater infant mortality rates than we've had in the developed world for probably a century or two. This brings up these issues again of reproductive ethics. You can address those. Oftentimes people think, well, you have the only guide to that kind of behavior or moral behavior is religious traditions. But no, of course, there's the whole field of moral philosophy, and you can address those in a secular way. I misspelled Gattaca there, but you know the film probably, Gattaca, where there's this very extreme selection for these perfect individuals, and they're the only ones in this very unfair screening process that get to go into space. As all super race projects go, though, that's completely doomed. That funnels all variation out, right, and gives you uniformity. And we know from evolutionary biology that is absolutely the last thing you want is uniformity. It gives you nowhere to go. In an adaptive sense, when things change, and things will change. Also, what do you do with, for example, Stephen Hawking? You have the Stephen Hawking wing here of the Institute. He has motor neuron disease. This is a genetic disorder. And the Gattaca phenomenon suggests, well, you know, you've got this particular disorder, or your child is going to have this disorder, so let's not have that child. Well, if that were the case during the time of Stephen Hawking, what if he had been selected out for that reason? If you're going to a space colony, you might want to have a Stephen Hawking alive along with you. So I agree that there are tremendous issues to be tackled philosophically and morally with regard to reproductive ethics. This is even worse. If we have this return of natural selection in these populations, and we keep people alive with medicines and all the systems that we use to keep that Earth genome alive, but you know you're going to a place that is going to be different, how long do you push an Earth genome? How long do you preserve an Earth genome? When does it become irresponsible to do that? And when does it become responsible to allow natural selection to tailor our populations to our environment? This is one of the, back to selection, this is one of the big moral issues and big philosophical issues that come up, ethical issues that come up. And it's one of the reasons that I'm happy to be working with a group called Icarus Interstellar. They are mostly physicists, mostly theoretical physicists, working on the propulsion technologies. They're mostly continental, a few in the States, but mostly in Canada, but mostly continental physicists. And they're working on the propulsion technology to give humanity the option of near light speed propulsion at the end of this century. They're proposing, let's take a century to think about all of these issues before we even try to build anything. Let's give an option at the end of the century. And I think that because of these issues of reproductive rights and morality and so on, that we should also give this a century, give it a few generations to think about. All right. Drift is a random increase or decrease of a gene, or random processes, increase or decrease the frequency of a gene in a population. Sometimes genes are linked to other genes that are under selection. Anyway, I don't want to go too far into this. Drift is, in our case, with considering interstellar migration, drift really has to do with the population, the founder effect. And I was mentioning that you can have these bottlenecks or these founder effects. One has been proposed about 75,000 years ago, or 73 here, an eruption of a supervolcano in Southeast Asia, the Toba eruption, is proposed. Now, this is not widely, I shouldn't even say widely, it's not widely accepted in anthropology, in paleoanthropology, but it's been proposed that this super eruption has something to do with the genetic bottleneck that appears around this time, and that the population, if we're looking at line that takes a big dip there right around 73, if that's the theoretical population of hominins around that time, by this time we're Homo sapiens sapiens, takes a crash at this point, and so what we've got after that is the resulting our founder effects, or our genetics today reflect only the survivors of that supervolcano. One way to think of this is a plan or a diagram by Steve Summerford. He's a space architect and he's working with Icarus Interstellar, and he's devised this vehicle to take some thousands of passengers to an exoplanet on the order of, let's say, less than a millennium, less than 1,000 years, some centuries. And he's got a series of villages, essentially. Each of these bars is a community, and they are revolving around the thrust axis, right? It's going that way, and as they go around like this, you're getting the effect of gravity. You can get a 1G, you can get half a G, whatever you want. An instance of genetic drift might be that some terrible catastrophe knocks out the bulk of the population of one of these villages, let's say. Right? They weren't necessarily selected against because of any property of their genetics. They were just unlucky. Drift David Raup was a paleontologist. I think he's still alive. David Raup is a paleontologist who wrote Extinction, Bad Genes or Bad Luck. And Gerard Vermeij is an evolutionary biologist at UC Davis. They've both examined the long-term trends in biology and evolution. And what they found is that those species that have the following properties have survived the longest. One is genetic diversity, life forms that funnel themselves into a narrow form. Again, they don't have that reserve variability to survive selective sweeps or changes in the selective environments. Numerous, that is, populations that have large populations or larger populations are less susceptible to catastrophe. And in particular, large populations that are widespread are less susceptible to any one catastrophe. These are important lessons from the world of paleontology. Species and genera in biology have known average durations. Species about 20 million years, genera a little bit more than that. Sorry, species about 4 million years, genera about 20 million years. Average duration for those. For all of these reasons, I'm using evolution as the guide. If we're going to try to adapt and to survive in environments that we that are new to humanity, then I think we should use evolution as our guide. So I'm devising this evolutionary framework for human space colonization. I'll skip a few of these. I'll go back one here. We have genetic diversity. Depending on whether you're zoomed in or zoomed out, humanity is either highly diverse or not so diverse, depending sort of on where you look. We don't really know whether this diversity, the human diversity today, is sufficient for the kinds of selective environments that we're going to find in environments beyond Earth. But for the moment, humanity is pretty genetically diverse, at least before the kind of selective environments that we inhabit on Earth. And we have been for 100,000 years. We're rather numerous. Our population, in fact, is very large, and it's difficult to imagine any one selective selective episode on Earth completely knocking out the entire human genome. It could happen, but we're numerous and we're widespread, so it's unlikely. One of the things that I'm doing with Icarus Interstellar is looking at what kind of numbers are sufficient for large scale or interstellar multi-generational voyages. For example, in this paper, estimation of a genetically viable population for multi-generational interstellar voyaging. I looked in here at this issue. Designing interstellar starships for human migration requires establishing the starship population, which factors into many variables, including closed ecosystem design, architecture, mass and propulsion. So I reviewed the population genetics for a wide variety of organisms, particularly vertebrates, and of the vertebrates particularly, I looked at primates and of primates, human populations. And what I identified, I'll come back to that one, here's a bit of the survey, and we're looking at these different figures of what is a viable population. One is called the effective population, and then there's a thing called a minimum viable population. What I found was essentially that among vertebrates, natural populations almost never are less than about 7,000. And for humans, who are vertebrates but also have significantly complex cultural systems that, or cultural behaviors that modify their interbreeding populations, for humans, a population or an interbreeding population of humans is almost never less than about 10,000. And multiple examinations of our genome suggest that you need a population for the proper genetic variation to maintain health over many generations, you need something on the order of 10,000 people. That doesn't mean that there haven't been extraordinary cases where for a few generations or a few centuries, people have been stuck on islands or things like that. But again, for long-term genetic health, you want large populations, and they should, let's say, start with on the order of 10,000. This is significantly different from just 50 or so years ago. When people were looking at this sort of issue, they were proposing populations in the hundreds. I'm proposing populations in the at least multiple thousands. In this study, I looked at a Again, we don't want to use the minimum viable population. This is going in numbers. Let's say if we build one of these things and send it to an exoplanet, you don't want to go with the absolute minimum number of people. My analogy for that is if you get on a plane and the pilot says, I have just enough gas to reach New York. No, you want a reserve. I was speaking with an engineer on the flight, and I was asking him about how engineers work on safety margins. And he said, well, it's very complicated. There's no simple answer to that. But I got some, anyway, you want some reserve in your population. You want to arrive there with a really good chance of survival, not just squeak in and hope that you can persist. So for all kinds of reasons in that paper, I'm suggesting a population of something on the order of 18 to 44,000, and I think of a number of a population of 40,000 people setting off on one of these voyages. It would be reasonable and would have a good chance of succeeding and persisting over, again, less than a millennium, but multiple centuries. One way to achieve evolutionary success by being widespread is to colonize different places, to settle different places, get off of the single species or single planet species that we are today. And here you see the beginnings or the sketch of a colony on Mars. And it's here that when these populations become really independent of Earth, if it's just a moon colony or just an orbital colony with significant links to Earth, that's still not safe enough. What you need is complete independence for long-term survival. And so you need biological independence, cultural independence, and of course all these other domains, economic and political independence from Earth. The way that Robert Zubrin put it, again, the author of The Case for Mars, he suggests that Mars is the place that we can reach, but that it's far enough where this kind of independence can occur. In fact, the way he puts it is that anywhere but Mars, for example, the moon or just orbital colonies, anywhere but Mars, the cops are too close. He wants independence. Well, go to the website of SpaceX, Elon Musk's company. You'll find it within a couple of clicks. The function of SpaceX, the reason it exists, it develops the technologies to lower space transportation costs, but the function of it, the reason it exists, is to ultimately settle Mars. So people are thinking about it. And we can get into whether it's a good or a bad idea, but people are thinking about it. The Dutch group Mars One is thinking about it. The evolutionary transition will be underway. These things are fuzzy, where the transition begins. People have just started transition research in biology. What constitutes an evolutionary transition? How do you identify the beginning, the middle, and end of it? That kind of thing. But essentially, they are known. They exist. And at some point in here, you're going to have this transition of Earth life from being restricted to the one planet to now multi-planets. This will constitute, as I mentioned, a transition in evolution. Now, evolutionary biology is itself undergoing significant revision or significant better understanding, greater understanding of itself. And this is a pretty extensive quote, but I'd really like to read it for you and really let you see how the reason this is so important, why I have this slide here of you know, what's going on in biology for this talk about interstellar colonization. The reason is that the tools, the evolutionary understanding that we're going to need to give ourselves a good chance of succeeding with planetary colonization, interstellar colonization, the evolutionary tools that we need to succeed with that are themselves being revised right now. Carl Woese just recently died. I had a very interesting email communication with him just before he died, but coming right from the depths of DNA, I mean, he is not on the sort of maybe new age Gaia sort of world of biology or evolution that you might think of when you hear this. But listen to this. Carl Woese, straight from the world of DNA, he says, a new biology for a new century. This is in 2004. Science is an endless search for truth. Any representation of reality we can develop can be only partial. There's no finality, sometimes no single best representation. I imagine this sounds awfully familiar to physicists. There's only deeper understanding, more revealing and enveloping representations. Scientific advance then is a succession of newer representations superseding old ones. Either because an older one has run its course and is no longer a reliable guide for a field, or because the newer one is more powerful, encompassing, and productive. And that's happening right now in what we call post-genomic synthesis. The history of evolutionary biology, there's a modern synthesis in about the 1950s, where they've understood now what genes are, essentially. They've got the double helix. And things change, technologies come along, we're able to read the genome now, and so, for example, in rather forceful ways, I've written an article, What Anthropologists Should Know About the New Evolutionary Synthesis. And so it's real. The new evolutionary synthesis is real. You can read all about it in various journals of biology, and evolutionary biology. And it's important for our understanding. Now, having said that, we can't wait until it's all known, right? That's an endless task. But we need to understand that what we thought of even as an undergraduate, what I learned about evolutionary biology is I wouldn't say out of date, but there's a much deeper picture. There's a much richer picture now. All of those issues then are involved with the biological adaptation of humanity and biological survival of humanity for space colonization. We also have cultural adaptation to do. Humans adapt culturally as well as biologically. This is even more fuzzy and difficult to grab hold of and start to think about, where do we start? How do we do this? One way to order our thinking is to look at what are called human universals. In human cultures, which are essentially our social and economic arrangements to survive, human cultures each have organizing variables, and the contents of how those variables are played out in each culture differs slightly, but each culture has to address these issues. Let me give you an example. This is a better way to describe what I'm talking about. Because of the nature of the human biology, or of human biology, because of the way that humans are biologically, we have certain metabolic requirements. We have certain reproductive requirements. Bodily comforts must be seen to. We have safety issues. So the basic needs of the organism have, of course, biological accommodations, but we also have cultural accommodations. And these are really what have allowed us to survive. Humanity has survived despite its biology and not because of it. We are a large-bodied primate compared to most primates, but we are a small, upright, hairless, subtropical primate, essentially. And yet we inhabit the high Arctic or the arid Australian deserts. And we're doing that. Yes, there are biological adaptations in those places, but most of the adaptations that have allowed humanity to be so wide-ranging and geographically not speciate like other animals so widespread has been our inventions and our cultural responses, our cultural inventions that allow us to persist in that variety of environments. So, for example, cultural responses to metabolic requirements are different food ways, different varieties of eating things, and different tastes for certain things. Reproductive needs are organized by kinship rules that differ worldwide. Right? Who is related to whom? Do we trace things through the father's line, or do we trace things through the mother's line? Now, we don't want to be deterministic and say that the ecosystem determines, right, the way that the culture plays out. That's been found not to work very well. However, we shouldn't be overly contingent either, or just put everything down to historical contingency and it's all completely unpredictable. No, there are observable effects of environmental factors or environmental variables on a lot of cultural outcomes, let's say. So this is one way to organize our thinking. Let's look at language, our variety of communication. How will this change? How will this change and adapt as we look into space colonization? Language is fundamental for humans. We, other animals communicate, but it's in humanity that you get, in particular, you get what are called deep or fuzzy symbolism, where anything can mean anything else. Language, then, specific spoken and gestural bodily systems of communication, including vocabularies and grammars. Some languages assign gender to nouns, and some do not. So there's some variation, right, even in basic things like our mode of communication. What about language beyond Earth, on a voyage to a different star, or even living on Mars for, let's say, 500-600 years? What's happening there? Well, one thing that we can certainly imagine changing is vocabulary. I was thinking, let's say you're on the way to a distant star, and you're halfway there, and you don't know Earth, you've never known Earth, nobody alive on the ship has been to Earth. All those generations have died off. And you're on your way to a planet, and maybe you're of the generation who will never reach that planet. You don't know of an ocean, you don't know anything of oceans. The concept of a whale, this giant animal, it's just a picture in a book. Would you really use that much as a metaphor? And those are not significant to just say, well, some metaphors will change or some the vocabulary will change. No, that's what constitutes our lives, right? The way that we communicate and our myths and our traditions and all that. That's vocally or that's communicated with language and the way that we speak, the kinds of symbols we use, all that. That's going to change as humanity encounters new phenomena and leaves some behind. Gesture, dialects, accents, based on different environmental conditions. In Skylab, at an atmosphere of 5 pounds per square inch, so a third of a bar, a third of an atmosphere, atmospheric pressure at an enriched oxygen content. It wasn't 100% oxygen, I think. It was about 70% oxygen. So different oxygen and different pressure, they couldn't whistle. They couldn't whistle. And that doesn't, it might seem, well, it's trivial, you know, who cares? But again, it's not the rockets and the robots and everything, that are, those are just the tools. What we're trying to do is have humanity. And now imagine humanity, no whistling in that environment. All of these things, yes, each thing might be a small thing, but when you put it all together, you have a different variety, you have different conditions for humanity. Or prosody, the cadence to speech. How does that differ, let's say, on Mars, where you have one-third gravity? What does that do to the production of speech? Dialect and accents, those are not without social significance. We're at about 7:57 here, so I'm going to move pretty quickly on a few more. I lived for a long time in Northern England, and boy, oh boy, if you come to London from Northern England with a Geordie accent, there are significant social things happening, right, with people of different accents. And they might even determine who your marriage partners are, right? So these are not insignificant. What would be the dialect? Would there be enough, or should we set things up so that there's enough social and reproductive communication between these groups? How do you set all that up? Well, those are all the questions that have to be answered, or at least examined. I'll move along past that one. How about food preferences? Again, these are ways to think. For a long time it was, well, it's just, if you think about space colonies, just sort of cast around wildly. Well, what would the economic system be? Or what would be, you know, how would it be done? Again, this is trying to organize our thinking, ordering our thinking by some of these human universals, and just giving you some examples. So food preferences, concepts of what are appropriate food and drink in certain situations. Some cultures eat certain animals, others consider them unfit to be eaten. Or what is appropriate in certain situations. If I'm having a wedding, let's say, and everybody has spent a lot of money to come to the wedding, and it's a big social occasion, and I'm serving really cheap hot dogs, you know, that's socially unacceptable. And it could have significant social sanctions, right? could regret that the rest of your life. So you have to follow the rules. You have to follow the rules to stay within, you know, to be socially viable. There's genetics, and that's reproductively viable, but you can also be socially inviable, and that can take you out of genetically viable. So will food ways change? Of course they'll change. We can't imagine, I can't imagine taking, you know, how many food crops do we have? Of course, we've done a lot of monocropping. We're down to, you know, rice, beans, corn, wheat, and so on. But think of all the spices, all the things that we like to eat. And this is, again, not at all trivial. One of the things that people take most seriously, particularly in migrant communities, migrants, most commonly and most, or one of the things that they consider most important is that they have the proper food, no matter where they move. Ethnic communities really want their own food ways, and they'll do whatever is needed to get them. I spent a lot of time in the wonderful country Iceland, where they have these things that you must eat to be a proper Icelander. One is called svid, and that's the mummified sheep face. If you can't stomach that, you're not a true Icelander. I guess it's like the lutefisk in the Lutheran communities. Or hakarl, this is fermented shark meat. The shark is buried under sand for a couple of months and then it's hung in a barn for a couple of months. And it tastes, my analogy was, it was like gym socks, eating a pair of gym socks. But you do it because you want to be socially accepted. So when it was served to me, of course, you eat it. And okay, then you're considered to be something of a human being. You know, maybe this person might be okay. Again, this is what human life is composed of. It's not just our reproductive biology and reproductive genetics. We have all of these social things that are going on. And these are all going to be changed in our new environments. Ultimate sacred postulates. This comes from the anthropologist Roy Rappaport, who looked at the origins of religious traditions on Earth, religious traditions in humanity. And he boiled it down to the communication of what are called ultimate sacred postulates. These are widely held among the culture beliefs that really are foundational in explaining the entire universe. So they're ultimate, they're first foundations. They are sacred, they must not be questioned. They cannot be questioned. And they're postulates, basic descriptions or basic understanding. Unquestionable concepts about the nature of reality. Some cultures, for example, consider time to be cyclic and some linear. What is the concept of the passage of the time for people on an interstellar voyage? What does a week mean without a sun? What about Earth-based religious traditions? How will they be changed? Look at what happened in the traditions of Western civilization with astronomy. So there's Herschel with his telescope and he sees a supernova and he writes, "I have witnessed a change in Orion's belt." And he notices the universe, right, is dynamic. It's not fixed. It's changeable. And along with a lot of people of his time, they recognize, aha, of course, we don't have the Earth surrounded by these crystal shells and the stars are just dots affixed to that light. No, you can break through. I've mentioned before earlier when we were setting this up, I've been waiting to use this overhead for years. So here we go. Actually, unfortunately, I think it's a 19th century fantasy of a 16th century woodcut. I really wanted it to be the 16th century woodcut, but I think it isn't. Anyway, it's a beautiful picture and it shows you the breakthrough of Nicholas of Cusa, one of these early astronomers, and he's breaking through this world of what was previously believed about the universe and he's seeing the mechanism and the all of the things that are actually going on out there. Well, what kind of transformative revelations will occur when humanity is on a voyage to another star? Or how about administration of justice or ethical systems, concepts of right and wrong, justice and fairness? Some cultures execute murderers, have death penalties, others do not. How about this? Again, from Iceland, here's Grettis, one of the great outlaws. If you read about the religious history of Iceland, they They proudly tell you that only two people have ever died for their religion in Iceland. One thing that they did, they're pagans, they're Vikings who came there and in the 850s AD, and when the Christian missionaries started arriving, a little bit later than that, the Vikings, again, pagans, they made it a crime to proselytize. They did not want to be converted. They eventually converted in 999 or 1000 AD. They did convert to Christianity. But before that, they made it a crime. The punishment for the crime, though, was not burning at the stake or any of these things a lot of other people do. Very interestingly, they used banishment, and they also used it for this character, Grettis of Iceland, this chaotic character who would go around and rob people. They didn't want him around. So rather than killing him, though, they didn't have that punishment. They sent him out to the wilds. He's excommunicated. He's banished to the wilds. That's one variety, okay? One variety of administration of justice that is possible on Earth, but it is not possible, let's say, on Mars, or let's say in a closed system like one of these ships going to a distant star. And how about this? Add the dimension of time, and I'll sort of wrap up here. Three ages to the stars. Archaeologists, we really like to divide things up into threes. My mentor, for a lot of my studies, pointed this out to me once. We like the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age. We like to divide things into threes in the Western tradition. Apparently, there are different gradations in different academic traditions. But let's use three. The first age, call it Age the First. These are cultures that are close to Earth. They have some remembrance from Earth. They might have, well, at first they do have people who once lived on the planet. And they are also distant from the exoplanet. So for their mind, Earth is the large one and the exoplanet is the small one. They will never see the exoplanet. These people are taking off. It's multi-generational. They'll never get there. What are their concerns? What are their priorities? How does this affect their language? Age the second, midway. This is really extraordinary, I think, for the human experience. They're far from Earth. They've never been on Earth. They have no direct knowledge of Earth. It's a history book. It's pictures. And yet, they are also not near the exoplanet, and they are never going to be there. This is a group of humanity, this is a population of humanity, culturally and biologically completely isolated. And what are their, again, what are their priorities? What are their interests? How do we accommodate that kind of thing? And then here, the Earth, the third age. Now, the exoplanet is near, and that's big in their thinking, and Earth is far in their thinking, and so far away that it's lost, maybe. I don't think it would be forgotten. In fact, I think that arriving here, now they have planetness to think about again, terrestrial bodies, and I think then they're going to dig into the archives of the exploration of the Earth. And how was that done? By sailing, by all kinds of ways of getting around on land. I think then they'll be resurrecting ancient methods of exploring the surface of our planet. The point is, if you're going 5 centuries or 6 centuries, or let's say less than 1,000 years, these are thoughtscapes that are reasonable for us, that we can handle. And that the propulsion people, again, are suggesting that these are going to be reasonable with not near light speed, but something substantially less, sub-light speed, but reasonable. It might be centuries, but again, less than 1,000 years to one of these exoplanets. Well, what I'm getting at, or what I guess I'll wrap up here on, is that, let me move forward to here. We can do better than just guessing, just kind of wildly guessing at what thing, you know, what might happen biologically, or what might be the consequences of this kind of thing, or the outcome of this kind of thing genetically or culturally. We have guides to what might happen. We have evolutionary biology, and we have all of anthropology that tells us about human cultural change over time. And those can be used to productively help. I think it's a good project. I think it should be done. It's not an abandonment of Earth. It's a preservation of humanity. And oftentimes people will suggest, and we can answer this in questions probably, I'm about to wrap up here. People will often suggest, well, humanity is the worst thing since sliced bread. It's the worst thing that's ever come along, so why spread this disease across the universe? I take a completely different view. I think that's a, for me, that's a pessimistic perspective that sees all of the worst of humanity. I prefer to look at the best of humanity, and I think that civilization, and at least the preservation of consciousness, is awfully important. We don't know of any other variety of consciousness in the universe. And so for me, my perspective, I sympathize with the perspective that it is a responsibility to preserve consciousness that explores and learns about the universe rather than to just let it fizzle. Last thing. About 150 years ago, or about a century ago, we had locomotives were the fastest moving objects on the planet. In that 100 years or so, we've been able to increase the speed of things that we build by about 1,000. Now we can go about 30,000 miles an hour with, for example, Voyager. If we make that same kind of incremental change in the next century, so let's say in the next century we also might get 1,000 times the speed of Voyager, that puts us into this thoughtscape. This is years and human generations elapsed, and this is different speeds that we might go. And so here's Voyager. So at the speed of Voyager, it's going to take 140,000 years to get to one of these exoplanets. Way out of mind. I mean, that's speciation type time scales. If we can increase spacecraft speeds by 1,000, by whatever population that the magicians will give us, then we can reach the closer exoplanets, or the closer planetary systems, on scales that are reasonable for us to think about. And we can even start to look at, for example, this is the thoughtscape that I'm looking at, 0.03 light speed and several centuries. And in that time, we can look at human biology, we can look at human culture as we have learned about it over several centuries, and we can see that, for example, typically we need about 300 years for an entirely new language. But there are gradations. Typically, there are gradations. And, Elizabethan English, you can kind of get the gist of it, but, you know, that's only four centuries ago. And you require special training, really, to understand it. So in four centuries, is that the kind of change? Maybe that's sort of the kind of change we're looking at. So what I'm thinking, oh, it's not here. Yeah, I think I wrapped it up there. What I'm thinking is that, again, we don't just have to guess at this. And if we're really going to give ourselves a good chance of survival, of making this project work, we can use everything we know about cultural and biological evolution to plan things out and give ourselves a good chance. All right, I think that's it for the moment. I'd be happy to try to answer some questions.
Thank you very much. We'll now open the floor to questions, both online and here in the studio. So if the studio audience can go to the microphone. And I'll go first to the Twitter feed. And there is a question right at the bottom here. Would you say that humanity should leave Earth or that it must?
Oh, I think it must. You talk to any paleontologist, anybody who knows the fossil record, and of course any astronomers, and they'll show you the wreckage of thousands of fossil species, and in the history of Earth life, about five major extinction episodes. One of them, the end Permian, knocked out about 80% of Earth life. That's ocean and land. They call it the closest shave in the history of Earth life. And so for all of these reasons, I think, yes, we must do it. It's a responsibility. It's not a luxury. It's an investment, not a luxury, in my perspective.
Thank you. Let's go in studio.
Hi. So I sort of understand why you say you think it's a responsibility to keep consciousness alive. But the one thing is we're leaving the planet in isolation. And I think about the fantastical interaction of the various ecosystems and ecologies. Even your example of the SVID and the Park Carl, those are examples of peoples using environmentally available, you know, animals and plants, and they're creating their culture on that. And I think about us going into space, and where it's a completely destitute and sort of a poverty-stricken environment, because all we have is ourselves. And old explorers, they would go across the ocean, but they would reach a land that was conducive to their survival, and they would be surrounded by a myriad of wonderful biological beings that they could interact with. And I also think about the resources. You know, we think about the idea of gold, and gold became important to us, so we mined it. And I think about what sort of resources would these planets have. But most importantly, people love to be outside, and they love to interact with the natural environment. So if you encased people in suits and they couldn't, you know, travel across the planet and see other cultures in a conducive environmental environment, don't you think that would be horrific? I mean, I can't think of why anyone would go unless it was an established penal colony, you know. But even those, you know, when they sent them to Australia and New Zealand, they had a beautiful place. Like, I understand what you're saying, but I can't see it would be viable. I think that what would happen is these interstellar people would be start to mythologize Earth and want to come back, and we would have kicked them out because our population was too big. Don't you think there's an importance in ecological environment and all these ecosystems interacting? That's my question.
Absolutely, I sympathize. I love being outdoors, and I've wondered myself, how would you have experiences of large area, and the sort of self-fulfillment of challenges to overcome. And I imagine the interior of one of these arcs that's perfectly planned, and everything is to schedule, and nothing ever changes. And I think, yes, you'd go stark raving mad. So it's got to be planned, and it's got to be made such that there is not necessarily imperfection, but there is change through time. The architects thinking about this kind of thing, I can't see you anymore, so I'm just looking generally, but the architects thinking about this kind of thing, you know, at least they're thinking in terms of, okay, large sight lines. And I've been thinking about, you know, what can you do on the outside of one of these things that gives you a variable environment, or even one that changes, that people can explore with regard to arrival at a place and the exploration of a destitute planet. I don't think that that'll be done. I think they'll plan things out so that you're going to arrive, in fact, you must plan things out so that you're going to arrive at a place that has, you know, minimal conditions for humanity. You've got to have water and you know, a few other things. So I sympathize. A lot needs to be planned. And one of the reasons that I'm, as I mentioned, that I'm so glad to be working with Icarus Interstellar is that they're taking that long-term approach and saying, we need time to do this. It's an awfully bad idea, I think, right now to use a sort of desperation motivation, like, oh my gosh, the planet is aflame, we've got to get out of here before everything falls apart. I don't think that's a good motivation for us. So I don't mean to abandon the Earth, and I think that we can and must solve all kinds of problems that we have here for humanity. But we can also do more than one thing at a time. We can also think, we can take another century to plan this kind of thing out. And I certainly sympathize about the idea of being trapped inside this thing. How do you get away from or get around that?
Okay, let's take two more concise questions.
Mine won't be so long. Exploration generally, historically, has been for gain. We want to gain resources, food, people, whatever. The distances being traveled here, we're talking about centuries, thousands of years, maybe even longer than that. There's no gain for the home planet. So who do you see funding projects like this? Is it going to be an extinction level event that drives this, or you think we're all just going to sing kumbaya and put money into it and fund basically the spreading of humanity?
Well, you know, the first space race certainly wasn't a kumbaya project. That was we're going to beat the other ones. So I don't think that's necessarily required. You know, the social environment on one of these voyages, again, it's going to be unique for the human experience. And it is going to demand getting along, right, in this closed environment with limited resources, it's going to demand getting along for a long time. Some have even suggested that the only human systems that are capable of that kind of attention on such a long time scale, several centuries, multiple centuries, are religious traditions. And that, for example, a church will build one of these things. I don't read a lot of science fiction, but I did read one a story recently about an interstellar voyage that was entirely built by Buddhists. And they built this gigantic ship, and they're just taking off. And over several centuries, they're able to maintain their interest in that project. So where does the first one come from? I don't know. Again, I don't think it should be done in a desperation mode. We have to scramble and put something together to escape a burning Earth. I think that's a... I'm not at all for that. But having said that, that's not an issue that I've looked into, right? The, you know, how is it going to be financed and so on. I'm presuming, again, that the propulsion system is going to come along and that somebody is going to want to do it. There are other people looking at that. I haven't really looked at that too much.
Thank you. And one final in-studio question.
I'm sorry I couldn't actually answer that, but...
I think this could have possibly been slightly answered already. So I think that it's a really good idea that we should have a contingency plan for the human, for humanity in general. Would you consider that there needs to be more, something done, like a big geopolitical event or something, or the geopolitical system has to be developed before we go on with this? Or should, like, say, companies like SpaceX, Interstellar, Icarus Interstellar go ahead with their ideas? Like, I guess, do you think that there'd be a better chance of success that we not like fix all the problems on Earth, because we can't fix everything, but that we geopolitically enhance like our interaction, or should we just keep on going with like single companies and single countries?
I simply don't know. I just haven't thought about it. I've been into the, you know, the population genetics and so on. So I've really been looking at, you know, if we are going to do it, what needs to be considered to make it a success. How we get that thing rolling, how we get it started, where's the social motivation to put the hardware together, that's a big question. Now, there are a lot of people studying that. At Icarus, I was at a conference in Houston a couple years ago, and at Icarus there were sessions, entire sessions, on how do you do that, how do you build that kind of motivation. I didn't attend those, I was in other stuff, but all I can tell you is that people are working on it, but that it's not one of my fields of study.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, no.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Cameron Smith.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.